Good evening, Dark City. It's the Permaculture Show. Here we are again. Right. Okay, well, I've got Bob with me as always. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Narice. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Certainly with all this weather, it's been amazing, hasn't it?
Yeah, oh, fantastic. I've had an amazing germination rate. I can't quite believe it. I don't want to get too overconfident, but it's all going very well.
Well, everything's rushing to get out of the ground now, isn't it? It's been delayed for a month.
Yeah, yeah, it has. Well, I've managed to, I've made nettle soup today, and I also made dandelion syrup this week, and I've been having lots of salads and lots of flowers. I'm feeling pretty good.
You sound like you got lots of energy.
I have, yes. I don't know where it's come from. At least I know where to focus it these days. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, we've got a guest this evening, so I'm really, really pleased to welcome Steve to the show. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Narice.
Welcome.
Thanks, and thanks for inviting me on.
No problem at all. Well, that is, you know, one of the main sort of functions of the show, as I was saying to you. I really want to spread the permaculture word and just get on people that are inspirational and that are actually doing it, you know, and getting on with it and just inspiring people to just do something, really.
Yeah.
So you're part of Permanent Culture now, which I am, I'm not ashamed to say, I'm a big fan. I'll follow the page on Facebook and also the website, which is a fantastic resource. So we'll put the links up to that. Is it Bolton, Steve?
I'm in Bolton, a little sort of northern ex-industrial working class town outside of Manchester. But it's very, very vibrant little town. There's quite a few growing groups popping up here and there. It's quite close to field and open space, which is good.
Definitely. So I suppose we just start at the beginning, really, Steve. If I ask you how you sort of got into
I discovered permaculture. Quite strange, really. I was at Ruskin College in Oxford, incidentally, where I met Mike from Permanent Culture now. And previous to that, I'd lived in a two-bedroom house in Salford, and I was really skint at the time. Are you still getting me there, Narice?
That was me. I didn't warn you that, Steve, previously, but for some reason I have a tendency to jump in and out of Skype. I think through my studies of the surrounding area, although Birmingham's on a plateau, I'm in a slight dip here. I think that's got something to do with it, but everyone else is there, so if I jump out...
Do I carry on talking then?
Yeah, you carry on talking and then someone else will jump in with questions. Yeah, I heard the intriguing bit at the beginning that it was quite strange. That was as far as I heard.
Right, well, how I discovered permaculture, I was living in a two-bedroom house on my own in 1992. And at that point in my life, I was really skint. There wasn't a great deal of work about. I was sat in the backyard of this two-bedroom house one morning, and I noticed that it was getting a full effect of the south sun. It was basically a south-facing backyard. And I thought, right, I can grow food here, because the sun was there all day, basically. It was a full-on sun trap. But I had no money at the time, but I had this idea of making a garden from nothing. So rather painstaking efforts, I found a skip full of topsoil about a quarter of a mile away. And I virtually emptied the skip over 2 days into a rucksack and a mountain bike, the soil to and fro from this site to the backyard. And I found window frames, I found loads of bricks in the area that builders have left. I made raised beds. I couldn't afford seeds. Seeds were really expensive back in the 90s, you know, sort of £2-3 a packet. So I went and pestered anybody who knew, you know, asked if anybody had any seeds. Went down to the allotment site, pestered some of the old guys down there. And I ended up that year where I was able to grow so much food that I could provide at least one large meal a day. This was from a little Coronation Street style house, like a backyard basically. So fast forward a couple of years, I kept this garden going, you know, it fed me, it kept me sort of fairly healthy, and I learned a bit about gardening. And I went to Ruskin College in 1996, and they were running this course called an Introduction to Permaculture course. I thought, looks interesting this, and there was some sort of vague blurb underneath about gardening. And I attended the first session, sort of got chatting to the guy a little bit, and I found out it's basically what I'd been doing at home, although in a very rudimentary way. And from that point on, you know, I'd sort of entered into the academic world, didn't have a garden to speak of, was going to be moving about between different student houses for the next 3 years. And I kind of put permaculture on hold. And after the death of my mother, when I graduated and moved back up north, got myself an allotment plot in 2000. And it's basically sort of my knowledge base has been developing from then onwards. And you get to the point sometimes with permaculture books and every other book where you're reading it sort of cover to cover, inside out. But you really need to do a course to kind of pull everything into line. And from discovering permaculture in 1992 through my own practices to actually doing a PDC, it's taken sort of well over a decade. But eventually, I had some spare money in 2011, and we went and did our PDCs with Patrick Whitefield. And it was kind of Patrick's course was a way of pulling a large amount of knowledge that I'd gathered over the years, practical and theoretical, of pulling it together into the system of permaculture design. So it was quite. It was quite an eye-opener, really, sort of going on the path of reading and practicing and trying stuff, and then actually going and doing the full course with a guy who's just got this incredible knowledge of ecosystems and how ecosystems work. And that was really how I got into permaculture. And like yourself, it's, you know, it's probably the of all the sort of philosophies and ideas and sort of practices that humanity's developed, you know, we really, really need to spread this one.
Because there
is nothing else, literally. You know, organic agriculture on its own can't do it. Plus, the agriculture would be too scaled up. You'd end up with a similar scenario where you're putting massive inputs in and only getting tiny outputs. So it's permaculture all the way from Mina East.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with that. I mean, it boils down to common sense for me. It's just common sense, isn't it? And like you say, that was really interesting story, because it just started for you with observation, really, of where the light was and how it was falling, and you know that's where it all comes from. But I'm a massive I love Patrick. He's just amazing. He has said that he'll come on the show, but I'm a bit scared to have him on because I don't know what he knows too much, almost. I don't know where to start with what to ask him.
He's a bit like it's like a sort of the British permaculture sage, really, where he has. I mean, a lot of practitioners have done lots and lots of courses, but Patrick's actually lived out in the wild in a teepee for a decade, where he was able to do all these field studies, and that's where he's developed his vast knowledge of ecosystems, guilds, and plant relationships within nature.
Mm-hmm. He's
got all the practical background stuff and the theory as well. So he's quite a special dude, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's worth a mention, actually, that he works from Raglan's Lane Farm, which is, it's Gloucestershire, isn't it, Steve? That's right.
Great setup on there.
Yeah, and I'm actually myself doing, he started running these online courses, which I was saying to Steve earlier, are fantastic, because obviously I've got the three kids here, I'm pretty tired here, short of cash, all that. So I'm doing this online. He's got this, so there's kind of a resource base there, and then there's a forum, and we also have Skype.
So, yeah, it's an ideal, it's a very inclusive way of learning that aspect of permaculture that you need to learn, really, isn't it?
Aspect that I'm trying to achieve here, so I can apply what I'm learning online to what I'm doing around me. So it's been really good for me. I mean, to do courses and go away is fantastic, but it's not a massive option for me at the minute, so you know it's been fantastic. So how did that lead you on to sort of the permanent culture now?
It's quite strange, really. I mean, that's another intriguing story. I sort of discovered permaculture as the word permaculture at Ruskin College, but I also met Mike there, Mike Thomas, who I do permaculture now with. And, you know, there was a decade age difference between us, but we were both working class lads who, you know, we'd sort of done various aspects of community work for. And the funny thing that me and Mike gelled with is two things, really. A deep and profound hatred for the Tories and a love of dance music. I'm a musician myself, and I write bits of drum and bass and dub reggae, and I've been in bands before. And Mike's sort of very much into, you know, very sort of modern electronic dance music. So we had these two interests. And it was kind of, you know, after we did Ruskin, we both studied at University of Bristol together. And as you probably know, Bristol's quite, in terms of alternative culture, you know, and permaculture and all that sort of thing, there's a very strong sort of grassroots thing there as well. So I kind of knew, you know, once I'd sort of lived with Mike for a couple of years and got to know him, you know, we'd argued a lot, you know, but good sort of solid arguments about politics and philosophy and stuff. But I kind of knew that eventually, you know, you get these sort of thoughts every now and again, thought, we're going to do something together, a project type thing, you know, and it was always on the cards, really. But I sort of, throughout the 2000s, I didn't see a great deal of Mike, and then when we did meet up, we'd sort of discuss what we were into, and, you know, I was into permaculture, and I explained to Mike's a filmmaker as well, that's another one of his really good skills. He's made an underground sort of classic film about dubstep, and I think he's also done some social care stuff for his master's degree. He's got a master's degree in filming. So there was this connection of Mike as a filmmaker and, you know, a very logical thinker and very organised. And from my side, I was sort of in permaculture gardening, little bits of political stuff, guerrilla gardening, but I was really veering towards away from politics and towards the solutions, really. You know, of course, permaculture is riddled with solutions to most ills that the political ideologies cause. You know, permaculture is there saying, well, actually, if you try this, you know, everybody gets fed, the local ecology in the area is sort of enhanced, and, you know, people learn all these new skills. And it was kind of, you know, I mean, I'd sort of racked my brain for years thinking, well, what will we end up doing? One day I just got a call off Mike. I've had this idea about us starting this this knowledge base, sharing knowledge, sharing skills of stuff that we actually do in our own lives, but also a lot of stuff that you've learned over the years. You know, academic stuff, non-academic stuff, activist stuff, history, you know, sort of going back to the commons particularly. That's one of the big areas that we were into. The idea of common land, basically, and that, you know, you have a commonwealth, and the commonwealth is people on the common land sharing the skills. So we'd always have this thing, Mike rung me up this day, blah blah, should we fancy trying this project, and I nearly sort of jumped down the phone to say yes to it. And the great thing, and I think why we've done reasonably well for the short amount of time we've existed, is we're both incredibly committed to social justice and ecology. I mean, you know, with our qualifications and stuff from going to Red Brick Unis and Ruskin, we could have easily, you know, and sold out and gone the career path and be earning 70 and 80 grand a year. But, you know, that just doesn't put it for either of us, really. It's not about that. You know, so permanent culture now, you know, we're both in the jobs that we're working in. I was working in, I mean, I'm a teacher by trade, I've worked in mental health, worked with refugees and asylum seekers, with sort of battered mums who'd, you know, victims of domestic violence. Mike had been running youth projects in Gloucester. And that sort of work for us, it came to the point where we were both unemployed. And you'd both sort of outlived previous work. You know, you'd done as much as you could. So, in a way, permanent culture now, you know, is, even though we're not earning any money out of it as such, is, you know, possibly step our next, if you want to call it, evolution of work, you know, where you're actually going into something that you're more comfortable doing, where perhaps you can help more people, really. And it's, you know, it's been a learning curve for both of us, really. I mean, it's virtually everything I'm doing now, you know, whether it's making rocket stoves, doing cob, you know, messing about, sort of tinkering and trying to invent stuff on me a lot. We sort of film everything now because we believe that there's a thing called practice in, I think it comes from sort of social science philosophy, and it also comes from general science. And practice is where you have sort of theoretical ideas generate that are then sort of put into the real world. And practice sort of happens at points in history with certain things. And we believe that, you know, permaculture now is in the practice stage where there's lots of people going out and doing it and applying it through design, through strategies, etc. But there's also an awful lot of people experimenting, tinkering and trying stuff out. So with all this tinkering and sort of experimentation, some of it will work, some of it won't, but the stuff that works, you know, we'll bang that up on our website or spread it all over social media, even if it's something dead small, like, if you, you know, creating a new plant field, trying these plants together. It's all taking the theory, experimenting, trial and error, and then bringing it into the knowledge arena of permaculture itself. So we think, you know, I mean, we're into permaculture, we're into a lot of other stuff, because the way we look at the future, I mean, I think permaculture will provide the food, quality, the skills that we all have to learn. To a certain level, it can, it, you know, it's quite good community building profit if it's properly. We're looking at a broader picture where basically you take the best sort of stuff that's developed from humanity, you know, certain things that have happened in history, the best educational models that suit everybody as opposed to a few. So permanent culture now is really, it's a way of me and Mike sort of fusing 2,000 years of ideas to pick the best of what we've done in those last 2,000 or 3,000 years, and but to have permaculture as the underpinning for all of it. And website and how we work and everything else is sort of underpinned by permaculture ethics. You know, and as I say, we haven't actually made any money out of it, but sure, you know, if we were asked to do paid talks, we certainly would be charging, you know, some of the exorbitant fees that are sort of expected in the world of seminars and, you know, sort of paid seminars and lectures and stuff. I mean, I've heard of people, you know, who haven't got a big name being paid £1,000 for an hour's talk. That's outrageous, you know. If you paid £1,000 permaculture now, you'd get me, Mike, probably 7 or 8 other speakers. You get loads of practical workshops and all the rest of it. So I suppose what I'm saying really isn't about money. It's just about trying to get these ideas. And certainly, you know, the fact that we are pulling all these ideas from history, we see that as, if you look at the permaculture mind, that's enacting the sort of holistic nature of permaculture by looking at all these ideas in history. So, you know, it's a very interesting sort of growth thing, you know, because you're learning all sorts of stuff all the time. You know, skill sharing left, right, centre, swapping stuff with people. And it's all very natural. There's no, how you put it, it's not attached to typical, if you like. It's a very sort of natural and very down-to-earth thing, I think, when you're sort of in permaculture, your daily life, if you want to look at it that way. Well, I don't know, do you see it like that, Maurice?
Oh, most definitely. I'm actually really on your wavelength, and I suppose that's why I'm so inspired by what you're doing, because that's sort of what I'm trying to create here in Birmingham. I mean, there's a lot of little projects going on here, and right. Sort of when I started the permaculture group, it was kind of one of them that, you know, like you say, Bristol, there's so much going on in Bristol and, you know, the places up north and, you know, in London, that, you know, Birmingham should really kind of stamp a foot on the map in permaculture terms. So, yeah, we're kind of, we are all sort of gradually linking up. And in fact, I found out today about a project that's up the road, which is why I know people, you know, slag Facebook off, and I understand why, but it was through Facebook I found about the about these guys, and they're only round the corner virtually, so I'm going to go up and visit them, and that's another community garden. So yeah, I really want to get into the, you know, the groups of, well, yeah, well, it's everyone really, isn't it? Everyone, yeah. You know, I don't really want to describe it in terms of groups of people, because it's just all inclusive, you know. We want to reach everyone.
You go beyond, I mean, I'm not mentioning as groups, once you go beyond that, because having groups and distinctiveness, sometimes it's a way of building tribalism, isn't it?
And
you haven't got that if it's just stripped down to the fact that, hey, this is people. We're all doing, you know, we're all growing, we're all sort of trying to look out for the community, etc. And it becomes a completely new thing, doesn't it, where, you know, this, it's the great permaculture, it's a great levelling agent in our times.
Mm.
You know, because things are incredibly bad in loads of areas. It's almost like sort of going home, you know, after you've been travelling away for years. It's like very human, it's very workable, and there's an awful lot we can do. And, you know, and I say this without arrogance or ego, but I think permaculture could definitely sort of restore the biosphere.
No, that I totally agree. Yeah, totally agree with you. Yeah, yeah. I know, it's funny. I had another meeting with council people today. I do like to talk to them, find out what they're up to, what they're thinking. It's right. Funny because around here, I did say to him, so we're deprived. That's what they that's what they say. We're deprived around here. I'm not really quite sure what they mean by that, really. But that's what we classed as, deprived. So, yeah. And that's just all. Yeah, I mean, that's where the sort of the group things come in, because they just want to know if you want to work with alcoholics and people with mental health problems. And
yeah.
Like, yeah, we do, but you've got to look at alternative means of working. And actually, the people I met from the council today, I mentioned resource-based economies and skill sharing and stuff, and they appeared to take it on board. I mean, it's difficult to tell, you know. But yeah, we're quite fortunate because, do you know Sandwell? Not everyone's heard of it.
No, is it outskirts of Birmingham, is it? Or?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a Bermuda Triangle between Birmingham and Dudley.
All right.
Yeah, it grew up through industry. That's why people sort of settled here rather than going into the main industrial Birmingham area initially, right. I suppose. And yeah, so we've got our own council, but it's fairly small, which is quite a help. There's a lot of face-to-face that you can have going on. Whereas in Birmingham, I think it's the second largest authority in the country, you know, there's no getting to see anyone face to face about anything, you know. So, that's what I've been doing really, very much, like you say, is just trying to link with people in the area, doing various things and get us all working together and supporting each other and making more of it. So I'm working with a local church at the minute, and we're hopefully going to get a community garden on there. working. I just want to connect with people and share the knowledge, really, and get people independent in the proper sense of the word.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you know, now, I mean, monetarism and neoliberalism, capitalism really has died. It's like a cork twitching, you know, where people still think there's life in it. And there is, and all that's left really is local resource bases that are generated from whatever grows best in certain areas. You know, it really is. That's, I believe, you know, that's the economy of the future, really. You know, locally produced and locally used resources.
Mm.
Because, you know, every area and every climate of the UK can produce, a lot of it can produce the same stuff, but there'll be some areas like the southwest, you know, where perhaps we'll be able to grow different varieties of fruit that we can't up north. But, you know, there's no reason why we can't grow this, you know, massive, diverse resource base and share it amongst the UK. Well, it seems fairly straightforward to me, really, in a way.
No, well, it's true. I mean, you know, someone did ask me a while back about, you know, can you be sort of, you know, self-sufficient as an individual? And the answer is no, you probably can't. But once you create this kind of network, that's how it all sort of begins to flow. And then, you know, I don't know. I hate saying these things now because they seem like such cliches, but it is all that being the change, and you start from you, and then that's how it fans out, you know.
It's true. I mean, people could say what they like about it, but that's how it's developing, isn't it? And
it's,
really.
Yeah. Well, of course, the seeds was the big thing. We were chatting about that earlier, weren't we? You know. Yeah, I've actually got some friends that are over in Bali. They're working with Humanitad, and they're working with farmers there now to start growing this red rice, which is the traditional heritage variety, as opposed to the stuff that's forced upon them.
Hi, Steve. It's Bob here.
Oh, did I go? I didn't even notice.
You did.
You went silent.
Yeah, you did, Narice. There is a caller on, Narice, who's been waiting for a little while. I don't know whether you want to bring him in now.
Yeah, why not? What's her name?
Hello, caller.
This isn't me, is it, by the way?
Yes.
I'm just using this channel because I'm having difficulty listening to the show via the webpage, so don't mind me.
Oh, so you don't want to comment?
I'd rather listen, if that's okay.
Yes, that's fine.
We've got a lot of stuff to get through anyway, haven't we, Narice?
We have. We most certainly have. Like I say, Steve, this show is an open forum now, so anyone that wants to come on any week and chat about anything relevant to permaculture, they are more than welcome. I'd like some of the guys from America to come on and talk about, I've never heard of them, but they're talking about all these crosses between, I'm going to get this wrong now, Bob, did you hear Miles was talking about this, and another guy's been emailing me about, is it plums and nectarines? Apparently it's quite common in America.
Yeah, I have heard about it. I mean, not in very much detail. Plums and nectarines. Yeah, well, they're very similar things, aren't they?
Or maybe it was plums and peaches. I don't know.
Would that make it a pleach?
Yeah, they've got all these bizarre names for them as well, yeah.
Or a pun.
Yeah, no, they have got all these crazy names for them. So, but no, I'd never heard of them before. But yeah, so anyway, back to the seeds. We've created a group now for the exchanging of seeds. So we've created it on Facebook, and I've also linked it to our group website so that people who hate Facebook can go on there and exchange seeds. And I'm hoping that people will just literally contact each other and exchange them, either locally or, you know, post them to each other. So I've put a list of the seeds we're holding in our seed bank, and I'll happily, if I can afford it, post them to people, whoever wants the seeds and wants to grow. And, you know, it's important anyway, but it's also in response to the latest legislation that I think is it the 6th of May now? That's going to be looked at and potentially passed.
Well, the truth behind it is since 2008, unless a seed is registered, you have not been allowed to sell it in the UK, in the EU. So that's already illegal. And on Monday, they are going to be voting on seeds and propagation materials. And the vote is likely to go towards not even being able to give away seeds or propagated material.
So, yeah, I want to delve a bit more into that draft document, because someone pointed out to me that there was something about there were exceptions on that, and one of them was passing seeds person to person, but it's all a bit confusing because you can't actually sell heritage seeds now anyway. So I don't know, what's your feelings on this one, Steve?
Well, there was all the Codex Alimentarius stuff that I mentioned earlier in seed bans in the US, and there was also a bill put before the Parliament in New Zealand about the banning of sort of cultivating your own seeds and sharing them. But I followed it for a little while, and there didn't actually seem to be any of these sort of laws put in place. Now, I think this is an entirely different thing, the European thing, of course, because the Codex Alimentarius thing's probably been going on about four or five years now. And you know, if they are looking at this sort of legislation, then you know, we need seed swaps all the time, seed sharing groups like your own, and we need to just basically just ignore it, and to even sort of cultivate even more different varieties of hail and keep the diversity going, carry on crossing and carry on, you know, creating new varieties of tomatoes or pea, whatever. I just think basically ignore the legislation, get on with it, but perhaps accelerate and grow and share even more than what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, the stuff going on in America with, you know, that is completely true. I mean, you've only got to follow a little bit of what Monsanto are up to with the marketing and stuff, and they own a massive share of the US seed market. You know, and there was it 50,000 organic farmers in the US filed lawsuits against Monsanto? Basically for a share of the seed market, because they're sort of dominating and pushing further and further into the seed market, where obviously their end goal is to have us all hooked on their seed. As was the tragic case with Indian farmers who were sold seeds that were promised to produce this huge yield, they didn't, and a lot of farmers really tragically ended up committing suicide. Thousands did, you know, over the last decade, all because of Monsanto. So yeah, it's a very, very important issue, really. I mean, if you have a government or an ideology that's able to control your seed stock, they've absolutely got you.
Well, I don't know about you guys on this one, but I will not comply with it.
No, same here.
Absolutely not. It's a fundamental right that everyone should be able to save and swap seeds.
Of course.
It's as fundamental as water, in my opinion.
Yep, I agree. And
at the risk of plugging my own show, the lead feature tomorrow is all about this EU seed legislation.
All right.
So if anyone wants to jump in on my show tomorrow, you're more than welcome to comment. In fact, Steve, if you want to come on, Nyreese is coming on. If you want to come on and chat about it from your point of view as well, I'll be more than happy for you to do so.
When's that, tomorrow night?
Yeah, 7 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Not sure I can, but I'd certainly like to, you know, I'd certainly like to come on in the future if there was a chance of it.
Oh. Yeah. All right.
I mean, what you can do, Bob, if you send me a message with some sort of link in it to what you're doing, I can promote that on all of our social networks and our website, if you like.
Well, what I can do, Steve, is give you a link to the podcast once we've published it.
Great. Brilliant.
All right, I'll do it through Nyreese in the first instance, because I haven't got you in my phone book, have I?
No. Okay, mate, that sounds good, yep.
Unless I can work out how to... I'm on a Windows machine at the moment, and it's very different to my Linux machine at home.
Yeah, I bet.
Anyway, sorry to push my own interests, Nairis.
Please do. Please do. I've told you before, Bob, these are the edgies. Yep. The permaculture edgies. That's where the magic happens.
Yeah. Quality is here. Diversity.
Yeah, exactly. So, Steve, have you got an actual sort of set site that you work from now then, or do you just sort of go to other people's sites, or how does it work for you guys?
Are you talking permaculture in Bolton sort of a place?
Yeah, you know, do you just go to community gardens, or have you got an actual site yourselves?
We've got quite a few sites. I mean, we've got a north-facing front garden that's perennial flowers. Got quite a large back garden where I grow hops to make my own beer with. Got a perennial herb section there. Salad, what I call the salad bar, which is a huge upright shelf against the wall with massive containers on with salad. So this is kind of, you know, zone zero. Then I've got two allotment plots that are about 5-minute walk away. Now, those two plots, I've got one plot that's completely and utterly perennial, everything on it. It's based on a sort of micro design of a food forest with my own variation. I've got some ponds dotted about here and there. And then the other plot that I've got on the same site, I grow sort of traditional sort of seasonal vegetables that all, you know, all the old boys on the plot grow. But the most strangest thing I've got, and there's a bit of a mad story here, if there's time, probably take about 5 minutes to tell you. I met this guy about 6 months ago, and he was called, he was our local community builder, that was his job title. And he drew me to this pub one night, and I was thinking, you know, God, I've never been in here. It's quite a dull-looking pub, big old Victorian building. And the landlord of the pub came over, and he went, "You, Steve?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "Come on, I've got something to show you." And he virtually dragged me out of this door at the side of the pub, at which point you're thinking, "What the bloody hell is this? What's going on?" And he took me down to these two sort of clay-covered tennis courts with the clay gravelly sort of finishing on the top. They're basically two large tennis courts with a fence around. And he pointed at them and he said, "They're yours, rent free forever." I said, "What?" And he said, "Oh, Gary's told me that you're into this organic gardening thing and that you want to try and grow vegetables in the community for community members." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." And he said, "Well, what are you waiting for? It's yours now." So, I mean, we acquired that site fairly recently. We've got some funding coming. Hopefully, we'll be able to get our hands on it next Friday when it's cleared. And that's going to be enough to do some infrastructure stuff to put upon there. We're going to try and avoid raised beds a little bit and try and keep it sort of ground level as we can. But we're probably going to have to put a few raised beds in there to start off with. And then we're going to make a structure from Cobb, some locally sourced timber that's lying all over the show. We've got some funding for solar panels for the roof. And the maddest thing is, when this little hut's built, I'm going to have the hut officially accredited by Oak College Network as a place that can deliver and design accredited qualifications for people. So what we're planning to do on that site, we're going to work with unemployed people and, you know, people sort of recovering from drug problems and people on the upside of mental health. And we're going to, while they're sort of helping us to grow, we're going to be sort of helping them to grow in the way that we're going to put them through accredited qualifications free of charge. And for us, it's all about, like lasting relationships with the community. Mm. You know, apart from sort of doing the courses and growing food and stuff. So on this particular site, our outreach work is going to be sort of visiting houses on the council estate where people will get a kit of a small plastic greenhouse, the type that you see for about £10. A couple of bags of compost, a wooden raised bed and some seeds and a few plants to start them off. And that's our outreach that we'll be taking from the tennis court site, if you like. We're sort of arming people up with kit and things that we've grown on the site. So quite excited about that, really. Well, that's the latest thing. But then the other land, and it's quite funny when you think about permaculture zones, because we've got a woodland that's about probably almost half a mile walk from here, and it's owned by the council, and it's just not been managed in the slightest, to the point where the woodland's degenerating. And me and my partner go down there every winter, and we coppice the woodland, and we use the wood for firewood. We've got a wood-burning stove in our council house here, and we've built these sort of beautiful wooden arches in the garden that I've got my hop vine and my grapevine growing up. So this resource, you know, it's a council on woodland. They can't afford to manage it, and it provides us with firewood every year, and we're actually doing the woodland a favour by selectively taking certain trees out so other sort of younger up-and-coming trees can come through, and nature's doing us a favour there, and we're sort of helping nature a little bit. We're doing the coppicing, and we're kept warm all through the winter, and we've got wood for, you know, if we're making things, craft type things, or it's just good to have timber around for, you know, a resource that you can apply to a lot of different situations. So that's, you know, playfully, my zone five is council-owned woodland.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's amazing. You know, it is quite interesting. We've got a few sort of ancient woods and stuff left around here in Birmingham. I've got one up the road from me. But, you know, I find the relationship between man and trees really interesting because...
Yeah.
Woods wouldn't really develop as we know them without the intervention of man, would they? You know, it's a massively symbiotic relationship there between trees.
It's very quite the unlikely synergy, isn't it? Where, you know, the modern rational mind wouldn't entertain the idea of that, but the modern rational mind is created in abstract. We don't live in abstract. You know, we live within a living ecosystem that feeds us, we feed our ecosystem as it feeds us if we do things the right way. So, you know, I completely agree with you, and you know the profound effect that trees have had on human beings generally. If you look at a lot of these sort of pre-Christian and pre-Islamic religions and cultures, I mean, certainly throughout Hinduism, Buddhism, paganism, and some of the older polytheist cultures, if you want to call them that, you know, trees are revered in every culture.
That's how I actually got into permaculture, because I was a member of the Druid Order, and I was studying the Bardic grade at that time, and it was just a leaflet that came through with the Gwersu that they sent me. And that's how I found out about it, and that's how I went on that first introductory course.
Interesting, isn't it? Because we were talking in Bristol last week. We did some talks at the Anarchist Book Fair, and we were saying about how what backgrounds people come from who discover permaculture. And you've got eco-political activists. You know, perhaps they've been very active for years, and then they've discovered permaculture, found out about the solutions that it offers, and they've sort of gotten into that way. And then you've got people who've gotten into it through politics, people through horticulture, and certainly through paganism, and, you know, sort of, I don't know what you call them, earth beliefs, I think I call them, where, you know, people have a reverence for nature as a baseline. I'm not calling it a religion, but as a belief system.
Well,
you
know, yeah. So
that's there in us, underneath all everything that's been sort of fed into us through psychology, religion, and education. I think that is right inside of us, that, you know, it is us. Our gift is what we do within nature, and, you know, acknowledge all these, the interlinked bits and pieces, if you like.
No, I think it does transcend religion. I mean, I'm not a member of the Druid Order anymore, because I don't think I want to link to anything that has any kind of connotations.
Yeah. Yeah, that's understandable.
I think the key for all of us is to do whatever we're comfortable with, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and don't be led. don't try and be a leader, but don't be led either. You know, just carve your own way.
Yeah. I must admit, I think that's why Druidry jumped out at me initially, because it does teach that. You know, it draws on sort of philosophies from around the world and teaches you not to sit at the foot of gurus, you know, and that is what, like you say, someone else was saying this to me the other day, actually, it's experimentation, isn't it? You know, that's what it's all about. It's about creating stuff. I'm kind of at this sort of crossroads now at the minute in my life of, you know, basically all I want to do is create stuff every day, not necessarily just, you know, in terms of growing stuff, but just in terms of I just want to make stuff all the time.
Well, ultimately that's what we're here to do, isn't it? We are a creative species.
Exactly.
And you know, for the greater part, that's what's educated out. And, you know, we're kind of brought up not to be creative, but to be consumers.
Yep. Consumers and workers.
Yeah. Well, slaves, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It is. Good citizens. Yeah. That's what I've started to... That's why it's the small steps, isn't it? Because what I've decided now is, right, everything I need. So the next time I run out of washing up liquid... Well, no, that happened today, actually. I ran out of washing up liquid, so I thought, right, I'm making some. So everything I run out of now, I'm just going to make. That's my current plan. So, you know, take it from there.
It's all doable as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And we touched on this, I can't remember if we were on or off then when we were talking about this, Steve, but, you know, there's this thing about, obviously, there's the, going back to the synergy, but if you, you know, there's that with honey, it's good for allergies and, you know, if you buy honey from your locality, it combats that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, it does go further than that. I think this is only theory, obviously. I'm not a scientist. but actually, interestingly, that's the point I was going to make earlier, that's another group of people that are quite prevalent in the permaculture world, is people who have trained as scientists or worked as scientists and have this kind of understanding of bacteria and kind of things that might be happening underground and microbes and, you know, there's that whole sort of science thing there, which is really important, you know, because...
Yeah, definitely. It gives more validity to permaculture, doesn't it, if a lot of it can be scientifically proven in terms of objective knowledge. People will go, oh, right, well, it works because science says it does.
Yeah. That's the thing, you know, that I kind of think is the important to get across about permaculture, that, you know, there is still a big element that when you kind of sort of initially express the ideas of it, that people, it's a bunch of hippies in a field. And, you know, I am actually a bit of a hippie, so I'm not going to deny that. But, you know, between the common sense and the observation and the actual knowledge we have of science, you know, it's not about going back and all having a horse and cart and like throwing your piss out in the street and it's evolution, you know, taking from the past, embracing the good from the future and then combining them and moving on, you know.
That's it.
Well, that's the problem with mainstream media, isn't it? They think that anyone who's got any regard for the environment wants to go back to the Stone Age, and that's absolutely so far from the truth. Mm. I mean, we're using modern thinking, modern technologies, but adapting them to a much more sustainable... Sorry about the use of the Agenda 21 word... But future.
Can I just say, that's our word, sustainable, that's our word. I won't let them take that word. I refuse. I won't comply. sustainable. That's our word, that is. Sorry. I've been meaning
right.
to get that off my chest for a while. I haven't actually said it out loud to any.
Well, I'm glad you have now. I won't worry about using that word quite so much anymore.
I shan't take that one. I refuse. sorry, I've cut you off in your time.
You're right, because there is two versions of sustainable, isn't there?
Mm.
You know, and the sustainable that we mean, you know, David Holmgren's, you know, version of sustainable of, you know, through perennial resilient ecosystems. Mm. And that's true sustainability, as opposed to, well, we have to sustain this so that capitalism can carry on raping the earth. And we have to just, we'll stop that, so we'll just turn that into a conservation area for a bit. You know, it's a whole new thing, our sustainability, but I think people will understand it.
And I think, did you have, I don't know, saw a couple of things on Facebook, Steve, about, was people giving you stick about the kind of political comments you had to say about the community and stuff?
Yeah, it was interesting. Actually, we put a couple of posts up. Mike put one up about celebrating passing of Margaret Thatcher, and there was another one that was quite sort of hard hitting political that we put up. But I got complaints through my personal email address. I got this guy saying, "I don't think that you are reflecting permaculture ethics in your thing about Margaret Thatcher." And I just explained that it's okay for other countries to mourn the passing of a tyrant by celebrating. Lots of countries do it and have it as part of the history. And this guy kind of, well, you know, we can't do that because we're English. And I just completely couldn't accept that sort of attitude, really. It was, you know, like that woman killed people because of her policies. You know, she put whole communities on the dole for decades, etc. But yeah, I don't think people expect, when they see the word permaculture, I think they expect a very sort of soft, benign liberalism.
Yeah.
I think, you know, permaculture is very, very radical, incredibly radical. I mean, Bill Mollison said it, didn't he, about gardening being, you know, one of the most subversive activities you could do. Then you had Mike Feingold, Bristol permaculture tutor, gardening is revolution in disguise, etc. And that's what all these people are kind of getting at, is
he's amazing, Mike. Yeah, people should look him up on YouTube. He's so inspirational. I love watching him. It really makes me itchy to get out in the garden and start doing stuff.
Yeah, quite live. Mike sat on our panel, actually, at one of the talks we did at Bristol Anarchy Book Fair, and it was quite, it was a talk about what we've been talking about. We did this talk called "Is Permaculture Political?" And I was meeting Mike for the first time. And he just looked at me and he said, "Is there really any need for this talk, Steve?" But with this big sort of grin on his face. And he was quite right, because, you know, it is obviously, you know, it's not a political idea or a political party, but because it provides solutions that politics has tried to give people for years, you know, under the pretense of, you know, we'll ensure that you live in a just society. We're actually there saying, well, actually, we can give you the just society without leaders, without hierarchies, without the exploitation of nature, etc.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is highly political in some way. Oh. But yeah, and all sorts of people moaning and whinging, and hardly any of the arguments were rational. It was all, you know, because we're into permaculture, you're expected to have this highbrow moral outlook, you know. But our thing was, well, I'm sorry, you know, Thatcher upset, killed people, you know, did this, that, and the other, and no, we won't show any respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think have we gone off now, or are we still on?
No, he's still on.
We're still on? Okay, I think we need to wrap it up now, Steve, but...
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on, and please, please come on again. We're on every Friday, 9 till 10.
Brilliant.
So, you know,
I'll just log in on Friday and sort of join in.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And, you know, thanks, Bob.
Yeah, no worries.
Another good one, spreading the word.